part of the game that Blake wants you to play when you're looking at his works is to start looking for some of the connections that he's got going. Say, oh yeah, I see how he sees that's connected to that. But also, I mean, he wants to push you right up to the edge, again, this edge of apocalypse, and look over the edge, and then he wants you to take a leap into that gap. And part of what that means is to use your imagination and start looking for other connections that he's inviting, but possibly seeing others that he's never even thought of. Just a couple things I want to say by way of introduction, and then really how this session will function. I've got some slides, and we'll flip through some of these that will give you kind of an introduction to some of Blake's works. And what I'd like to do is sort of give a bit of a running commentary along the way, because he's not a poet that's immediately accessible, and yet in another way he is. I mean, there's arguments over many aspects of his work, but I mean, one argument is sort of Blake, should he be read like the Gnostics? I mean, he's got this big secret system, and you have to go take a college class before you can sit down and you know, buy the Blake Book of Poetry that's over there in the bookstore right now before you get anything out of it. And especially his later works, you might think that's true. And yet, I mean, his intention is exactly the opposite. What he wants is for you to get it immediately. And which, just with a little bit of a help, I mean, I think you'll start to see things immediately. And I hope sort of see why I'm interested in this guy. To situate him, he's a late 18th century English poet, is typically associated with the British Romantics. So people like Wordsworth and Coleridge, who met him, but he really isn't in their circle, and he's even better thought of as, I mean, before them. Wordsworth went to visit him in London and concluded that he was nuts. And I mean, and reading his some of his later works, you would probably come to the same conclusion without sort of seeing some of the system. But Coleridge also visited him and was convinced that he was a genius. So somewhere in between. A couple reasons why I like Blake so much, and they have to do with trees. And one of them is the line they read in my blurb at dinner. I mean, and I've just got a facsimile edition of some of his poetry here. And in their little intro, it lists that as the very first line of the bio, which I thought was interesting because I hadn't read this one before. But it says, William Blake was born in Soho, London in 1757, and at the age of 8, saw a tree filled with angels on Peckham Rye, their bright wings bespangling every bough like stars. And he continued to see visions like that in trees his whole life. And there's another tree story about him that when I first heard this, I knew that this was somebody that I could, like, spend some time studying. And the story goes, he lived in London, and someone knocked on his door, and he didn't answer the door, and there's a friend of his, so then just walked back through to see if he was back in his garden. He was. Blake was back there with his wife, reading Paradise Lost, the Adam and Eve scenes, in the backyard, up in their backyard tree, both of them stark naked. And, I mean, it's a funny image. And, I mean, Blake is purported to have said, come in, it's only Adam and Eve, you know. So, I mean, someone who would do that seems to me somewhat intriguing. And I saw a play about Blake once in London. Of course, that's the scene they open the play with, just because it's, you know, sensational. So you get naked people on stage. And, anyway, if you could flip a slide for me. I'm going to jump around a little bit at the beginning, and then I'm going to zero into Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience, which is his early works, his lyrical poems. Those are his hymns that are the most accessible and probably the most fun just to sit and read, rather than his longer sort of prophetic books, if you're just sort of not that familiar with Blake. But I want to jump around a little bit on the way in. And where I'm starting, this is from a work that he also wrote fairly early in 1789 called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. This is a plate from it. You can see, I mean, he was an artist and a poet, and so this is his work, and he's a rare, one of those rarities who's actually equally famous for both his poetry, you know, so in the English departments we get to talk about him, and in art, so art history classes, now they don't care that much about his poetry, but they do spend some time talking about his place in art history. Blake married the two together in his works and produced, I mean, books like this. I mean, and when he was printing them, they looked more or less like this, little books that he was an engraver, and he would engrave the text himself and a picture so it would be married there together. And this prophetic book has been called the most perfect English book ever made. And if you don't own a copy of The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, you should. It is. It's my favorite book in the world. And one reason why I like it as much is because it's full of proverbs. But we'll get to that later. And I forgot to mention that there will be a test at the end. This is a shalom test, so it won't be graded. But I'm going to give it to you at the end, and you can just take it away with you and look at it. And if you want me to grade it later, just flag me down tomorrow or something, and we can see how you did. It's a proverb quiz. What I wanted to use this for was just to point to this little kind of cartoon, and I know it's blurry and a little bit small, but this is in the middle of Blake's Marriage, Heaven, and Hell, and this plate's called the Renovated Man Design. Blake used it in different places. But there's this little cartoon, and he liked to decorate his place with all kinds of them. You see, they're busy. There's activity everywhere. This one sort of reads like a quick story of how to go about reading Blake himself. And it's really also commentary on education. It's a commentary on on how books should function. But how I want to see it for a minute is this. Here's Blake giving you some advice on how to do what we're doing right now, and that is, how do you go about reading Blake? Well, let's see what Blake says about reading Blake first. And if you can take my word for some of the blurbs, if you take this as a time sequence, at the very beginning, can you make anything out there? I mean, they're little figures, people. You see anything? I mean, I'll just tell you what. It's a little winged nurse sort of psyche figure, as she's described, and she's playing with this little tiny baby who's standing up, like just learning how to stand up. So stage one, you're born. What do you do with a kid? If you want to educate a kid, you play with it, is the moral of that story, okay? You're not teaching this kid anything, you're just sort of playing. Then time passes. You move on, and you've got something else going on here. This bigger figure here is more of the adult figure. Many of Blake's figures don't have clothes on, and so I'm not sure that's part of the education allegory or not, but we don't have to take Blake sort of too far, I guess. Or people looking in the window here might wonder what we were up to if we're all in here naked. But so here's this adult figure, and here's a youth now, this kid bigger, and the kid is pointing, and you can see this if you have a facsimile edition, it's pointing down to a text between them. Moral of the story, you know, you get older, kid reads, but instead of lecturing, which is what I'm doing right now, you know, this is a very un-Blakean method of sort of telling you anything useful about Blake, and I can't tell you anything useful by just telling you something, because all that would do would be to impose on you, to oppress you. But you can ask questions, which is what this youth seems to be doing. Saying, well, what's this? I mean, inviting the question. So, I mean, I hope to get to a more Blakean method here pretty quick, and that is to give you a chance. We'll look together, and you can say things. But then, stage three, you can see, you get to, and here, there's a little bower, and here's this youth with another book reading by himself. No oppressor, no educator there to say, read it this way. You've got the text and your own imagination. And if you read properly, if you look at the world properly, then look what can happen. You can see visions and dream dreams and have an apocalyptic experience, which is what this guy seems to be doing. And in some versions of this, that you can see the book better, but it's right there, but it's painted the color of the hill in this one I have a slide of. And there's a little skull here, but he's looking up and there's the sun behind him and he's seeing something. The interesting thing that I find about that, though, is this, is that books are important. I mean, and even having some people aren't asked questions if it's important, you know, but doing it yourself for Blake is one of his mottos. And at some point, having the book, I mean, it gets left behind. So some people approach Blake by, I mean, in a Gnostic fashion, saying, you got to know all this stuff and all these details. I mean, pound in all this information. I mean, it's ultimately, I think it's un-Blakean, but to take the book, to look at it yourself, and then to get rid of it, I mean, it's just, it's one thing that can move you to do what he did. That is to be a visionary. I mean, and his ultimate goal, I mean, has several, but is to get you to see the world in a perhaps a different way, and to see visions of your own, and then maybe to go write some poetry of your own. And not just to take him and carry him around and talk like Blake. So, if you could flip the slide. Oh yeah, I had a closer up view. What do you know? Forgot. See, now you can see it. Oh well, next. Since what I've been doing all week is talking about poets who write about trees, then mainly what I've tried to do is pick some slides of Blake's that have trees in them. And I mean, it's not very hard because he liked trees. I mean, here's from his series, he illustrated Milton's Paradise Lost. So here's the Garden of Eden. And surprise, what's that in the background back there? It's the Tree of Life, or the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil. Which often in the way he depicts it, it is the same tree. And for Blake, what something is always depends on how you look at it. And it's an important principle for him, you know, in terms of absolute terms, what is something? Well, it depends. And I'll get back to that. But there it is, the Tree of Life. So there's a Blake version. Go ahead and flip ahead. One of Blake's chief themes throughout all of his works is the fall. And he's going to think about that fall story in a biblical sense and think about Adam and Eve, but not only in that sense. He's a Christian, but the way he's going to approach stories is there's lots of ways to tell a story and get to the point. And the Adam and Eve one is a touchstone that he'll refer to over and over again, but it's not the only one. And it's not necessarily the right one. That is, it's not right if you take it as the absolute way. So what he wants to do is tell it, well, I mean, like Jesus in the parables. Well, if you don't get it when I say the kingdom of God is like this, then I'll say it's like this, and I'll say it's like this, and I'll say it's like this. So he'll keep saying, let's keep thinking about the fall. But all of his works are engaging this notion of human beings are separated from God by a veil, by a gulf, by something. So switch to the next one. So there's his picture of the actual moment of Adam and Eve falling. And let me just stop for a minute and just see if you see anything interesting there that you want to point to. Is it dark enough in here? You can see that? Should I turn off the light?
We can shift the shade on the too. Snake is the apple in its mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, so it becomes a kiss. The fall is a kiss. Now, what does that remind you of?
Judas?
Exactly. I mean, this is the connection method Blake's always got in mind. One thing is always something else. And so there's biblical stories. I mean, the Bible itself does this. You know, you read an annotated Bible, and there's all these notes that say, well, this verse is quoting this one. This is, and so it's not something he's inventing. He's just sort of playing with his chief text that he's thinking about. But he doesn't only have the Bible in mind always. He likes Greek myth as well, and he's very widely read. And you see anything else going on there that just interests you about that as a
branches.
Fall picture?
And yeah. The water coming out of his lightning branches.
Yeah.
That's
yeah, I mean, those are branches, but it is like a lightning storm at the moment of the fall. There's the cinematic effect. The storm starts and the sky turns black.
What's with the head of the snake? I can't quite see.
It's kind of rooster crown. I don't know. It's like.
There's the cockhorns on the tree.
Well, its eye is kind of on the side. Its mouth is long.
Yeah. Well, Adam looks like he's saying, "What's going? I don't know this girl."
Yeah.
He's totally oblivious.
Don't blame me.
He could be saying that already.
Yeah.
Don't blame me. But even look at his position, it's fairly interesting. I mean, what position is this he's in?
If the tree of life, or the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, it tastes the fruit of it, it looks like the fruit is tears.
It's tears.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the verse in Ecclesiastes about the greater the knowledge, the greater the sorrow.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. And Blake has a proverb in Marriage of Hanel, excess of joy weeps. And he's playing off some of that. Okay, so, I mean, it's also interesting. I mean, that tree doesn't look, I mean, it's got a few leaves, but it's, you know, it's not very green, and the sky's black. Again, I mean, that's the sky, and that's like the thunderclap when Jesus died on the cross as well, somehow.
Well, the tree of life is very thorny. Everything's all thorns.
Yeah.
Like it's something to stay away from.
Yeah, the roots included, yeah.
You can hardly tell where snake stops and the roots begin.
Mm.
Also, it looks like there's a volcano under there.
That thing, just the cone? Yeah, Mount St. Helens.
The tree's not really connected to the ground. It's kind of just sitting on it. Somehow. I don't see that any of those roots actually go into the soil.
Yeah.
It's almost like tentacles.
Yeah, it does look like that, doesn't it? So, the fall is everywhere in Blake's myth, and just one other word about cosmology, since we still have cosmologies in the air from the last session. One version of Blake's cosmology, and he's got, you know, 100 of these, but a dominant one that gets back to over and over and likes to tell stories. At that moment, when Adam and Eve eat that apple, for Blake, one way he likes to think about this, and I mean, he's very literal in one respect. I mean, he likes to read the Bible sort of literally, meaning taking words very seriously. But what happens is the world, and he liked to say that the world was flat. And partly is because he couldn't stand Isaac Newton, and he couldn't stand the modern scientists. He viewed them as the Antichrist, because they're saying, look, we can learn about the world and ourselves through our senses and study things and get rid of subjectivity and imagination, and we can learn all kinds of stuff. And Blake hated that. He was an early critic of that, saying, no, you're never going to learn about what really matters beyond the veil, using your five senses. So he liked to say the world was flat, just partly because everybody knew it was round. So at the moment of the fall, if you've got a flat world, the world literally turns upside down. And this is one of his ways that he likes to think about this. So think about this. So it flips upside down at that moment. And I mean, you don't feel it, you're just now upside down. But what happens then, if the world's upside down, and these people then are still worshiping God who's up there, I mean, what happens if you're worshiping that God who's up there? I mean, God isn't. I mean, who is up there if you're upside down? If you want to think in spatial terms. All right. I mean, that's not God up there. I mean, God was, you know, down there or someplace else. I mean, if everybody's confused, and in Blake's cosmology, that's exactly what organized religion has done. They're worshiping some God that's not God. And it's sort of Satan, and it's sort of like the Old Testament God. Blake's real sort of God he wants is the Jesus Christ sacrificial lamb figure. That's what he wants to get back to over and over again. Okay, flip ahead. Another manifestation of the fall in his myth, another mythic system, some play around with this, that the creation of Eve, actually, the separation of the sexes from the unity itself was a fall. So a fall into to division of the sexes is a manifestation of that. So by the time they eat the apple, I mean, that's one way to talk about it, but already God creating Eve out of Adam is a manifestation of a fallen universe already. So in lots of his myths, he's got Adam or Eve or some version of them running around trying to get back with what in Blake, I mean, he's got all this weird language, it doesn't matter, but to get back with your soulmate and put them back together and undo the fall. And so go on to the next one. And again, one way to think about undoing the fall is to think about redemption. And again, the tree of life. I mean, there's the tree of life again. Yeah. I mean, can you see anything unusual in that one?
What are those heads? Down below. What are those gorgons?
I mean, the people at the base of the... Yeah, I mean, there's a female figure down there, and there's a male figure at the base of the cross, sort of dead.
That's Adam and Eve again.
Well, I mean, that's...
Stem from that fall.
That's one way. I mean, that's sort of Adam and Eve sort of grown old and crusted. I mean, this guy here with the old face is a guy that shows up over and over, and he's showing up already in Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience. You'll see him. I mean, he's got a name in Blake's myth. His name is Urizen, and he becomes this symbolic sort of figure for all kinds of things, but he becomes sort of that sky god that people are worshiping that's not really it. So here's this dead sky god. When Jesus dies on the cross, what organized religion is sometimes seeing as his daddy and making him do that for everybody and killing his own son to save him. I mean, that sort of aspect of atonement theology, Blake is giving comments on already in the 18th century. But more tree of life, and then the snakes even there, its feet. Okay, next. Here's that same old guy, Urizen. Looks like a Volkswagen here to me, sort of. You know, it's like he's got four bumpers. I just put this in also again because trees are, if everything's connected to everything, trees will be a manifestation then of this. I mean, the tree around this god that's not really the right god is a dead tree. It's a tree of death here. And this is a title page of one of his other books called The Book of Urizen. So this is this guy's book, which reads a lot like the book of Genesis smashed together with Revelation, beginning and end. And it tells the story of this creation that is a gory, sort of horrible creation, looked at from one point of view. From another point of view, I mean, it is this great thing, but I'm not here to, I don't want to talk about the book of Urizen so much. It's just to say, look at the trees, the stone tablets behind, I mean, this is like Moses with his tablets. When he's writing down this stuff, or it's getting written down in books. Think about the book again. How does Blake want you to read books? Imaginatively, we could say. And part of what that means is you better read the Bible imaginatively. You better not just look at it as a stone tablet with a law on it that you need to follow. I mean, this sounds very familiar to Lutherans, doesn't it? I mean, in fact, I mean, Blake has sort of weird ways of saying all kinds of things, but if you just sort of translate a little bit, it's not very radical in terms of its theology or some of its implications. He just liked to take things to logical extremes and then say, well, let's literalize the image of this for a minute and think about it. So he doesn't like this guy. Because he deals with stone tablets and words that have been written into stone and therefore been killed. And one of the great dilemmas of any romantic poet is, how do you keep words alive once you write them in a book? The romantics are sort of known for this new type of poetry, and one of the things that was new was this sort of wanting to keep their works alive and changing, and they all dealt with this problem in different ways. And I'll show you in just a second how sort of Blake is thinking about that problem. But he doesn't want himself to turn into this guy, and any writer of any book is always at risk of being that guy, or any reader of any book, right? I mean, if you read a book and say, this is what it's, again, the lecture mode, this is what it says, this is what you think, I mean, this person, even though in Blake Smith, he's not all bad, he's necessary, because if he wasn't around to build the material universe, when Adam and Eve were tumbling through space, they'd tumble forever and never land. So this guy sort of builds something, they land on it, and they've got a place to start, and then the redemption can start taking off again. Okay, next. Another title page. I threw a few title pages in here, again, so that I'd remember to say a couple things about titles in Blake. And I mean, this is something that I'm working on in my own research now that I'm probably more fascinated in than you necessarily will be. But if you think about, I mean, there's that Emily Dickinson poem that is sort of a perfect fit with this. And they've been saying on NPR lately, if you've been listening, I mean, a word is dead when it is said, some say. Have you heard him saying this on the radio? I say it only begins to live that day. Blake is sort of confronting that problem constantly. Is a word dead when it's said, or is it alive when it's said? When you write it down, then, I mean, it's some of both. He wants to keep it alive, and he's got a number of techniques to do it. I want to point to a few, and then I'll stop just talking. We'll just start reading some poems in just a second. But you think about title pages. Title pages name things. I mean, exceedingly important, you know, what you're calling people and what he calls then the names of the people in his myth. And we've known for a long time in reading Blake, we're not sure what to call him. That guy in the last play, his name is Urizen, the Book of Urizen. But no one knows how to pronounce it. I mean, is it Urizen, your reason, your Urizen, like horizon? I mean, Blake's making all kinds of puns with that. And he wants to keep it sort of not fixed. Because if it's not fixed, maybe it won't make the word dead. It can be a number of things. And title pages are one of the most important then places where that's going to come into play. What's the title of a work? Well, you can say what it is. If that's what it is, you're putting at risk fixing it and killing it. So the title of this work is what? I mean, I've already referred to it. It's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, okay? I mean, and that's what everybody in sort of the Reads Blake would call it. But it's not. And when we get to some of his poems, you can see what the titles of some of those are. You know, you look in any book and it'll say what the title are. But what I believe, we don't know what the titles of many of his poems are because he's playing games with us to keep them a little bit up in the air. And the up in the air business in this one, that's why I put in, has to do with that thing in the tree. The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. But there's something in that tree up there that doesn't look like branches, and I don't know if it's clear enough to see. Can you see anything in that tree?
Bird?
Well, there's birds flying around, but just, I mean, here's a tree, there's another dead tree, you know, all these dead trees. I mean, like, here's the surface level of the ground, and here's all this fire stuff down here, and here's heaven, and here's hell, and there's two naked people kissing, and then all these naked people sort of floating up towards the skyline. But in this tree, this thing right here, see that? Me again, you have to take my word a little bit for this, but you know, I've looked at a lot of the originals of these, and I mean, it's not branches, it's the shape there. I mean, and what I see is a Q, it's an inverted Q. I mean, so here's the zero, and here's its tail, but inside the Q is this X, see that? It's kind of an S. Now, if it doesn't mean anything, then who knows? But I mean, here's my 10-second version of this, but we'll look at some more titles along the way. I mean, what's the title of this work? The Marriages of Heaven and Hell, maybe. Or maybe even something more unpronounceable, The Marriage Q, The Marriage Qu of Heaven and Hell. Why would there be a Q stuck in a tree that's inverted with an S in it? I mean, I could my quick answer would be it has to do with Proverbs. The author of the book of Proverbs is who? Who wrote the book of Proverbs, at least the Bible says? I mean, all the tradition says.
Solomon.
Solomon, you know. So I, Solomon, and it talks about the wisdom of Solomon. And, I mean, the book of Proverbs actually says, Hebrew is Kohelet, or Koheleth. I, Koheleth, which means teacher. That Q is Koheleth, the writer of wisdom. Blake's sort of emblem of, this is a book of Proverbs that's going to follow. And a few plates later, there's a list of the Proverbs of Hell. And the Proverbs of Hell, because it's an inverted book of Proverbs. It's not the book of Proverbs, which is, if you read it, a book which says at the beginning, these are the Proverbs of prudence, of being careful, playing things close to the vest, which is not the type of wisdom Blake wants. And when he would argue, somebody got a hold of that text early on and screwed it up. So if you're going to read the Bible correctly, you better read it imaginatively. I mean, and for Blake, what that meant, I mean, and he's ahead of his time in this. I mean, he's basically saying the redactors got a hold of these early texts and they redacted it and killed it. So you need to be careful about how you're reading, especially wisdom, because wisdom is the type of thing we write on tablets and tell to each other. So he's going to be advocating a certain type of wisdom. So again, the marriage, something of heaven and hell. And the other thing that just kills me about this, that I still don't know if it's there or not, or whether it's just my imagination, but look at this. The marriage of, now take that F of the of, turn it into a P. Can you see anything there? P-L-A-T-O. You see that? See the marriage of Plato? There's a P, there's an L, there's an A, there's a T, and an O. The marriage of Plato, heaven and hell? I mean, no one believes me yet that's there. But it's just, it's, you know, you start seeing things when you're looking at sort of busy plates. But, I mean, that's partly, Blake wants you to, but, you know, then you want to say, well, I mean, is it really there? And Blake's answer to that question is, the man who pretends to inquire into a self-evident thing is a knave. Is it really there? Well, isn't it self-evident? I mean, and then you say, well, which is it? Which way? And he says, isn't it self-evident? And that's all you get. Okay, so next. Keep going. That's another title page I don't know what I'm talking about. Okay. So we're getting closer to the Songs of Innocence and Experience, which started Songs of Innocence, his first sort of successful book that he printed in this fashion himself in his basement with this engraving technique. And then he's got this idea to write some Songs of Experience to put next to it because he liked to think about things, again, making comparisons. And he's got this whole explanation for sort of putting things that are kind of opposite to each other next to each other. So I just was going to flash by a couple of these to show you. Here's the title page and the frontispiece from the Songs of Innocence. Again, I mean, here we're back to this tree, right? Here's the tree of life, the tree of knowledge. It's an apple tree. And then the frontispiece over there just shows this piper with his muse sort of flying over his head. Now, next one. Here's the title page and frontispiece to the Songs of Experience, which is attached to this. Once he wrote Songs of Experience, he always published the two together after that. So Songs of Experience, here's Adam and Eve again, or that old guy, Urizen, and his wife, dead, with sad kids. And there's that piper who's now not a piper. He's describing the poetry as a prophetic bard. And he's sort of giving his muse a piggyback ride because his muse is kind of tired by now, but he's experienced. Okay. And throughout the Songs of Innocence and Experience, then, Blake is constantly pairing different poems that are meant to be read next to each other. So here's his poem, The Lamb, in Innocence. And then in Songs of Experience is The Tiger, which has some lines in it that refer back to this, so he's asking you to think, you know, think about these things. as being connected and make some connections. So finally, poetry, we finally get to it. And what I'll do, it's too blurry to see, I'll read this one, and you can look and see the picture, and then I'd like to play a musical setting of the tiger. I'll flash that one up there, and you can just listen to that one being sung. So this is The Lamb, and the order of my slides in here, in a sec, I mean, I just decided to put them in the order that they show up in Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience. After our, this sort of introductory stuff. So this is The Lamb. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bid thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead. Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly bright. Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Little lamb, I'll tell thee. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. He is called by thy name, for he calls himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I a child and thou a lamb. We are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee. Now, these poems and the Songs of Innocence and Experience, you can see, read like children's poems, and they are. And they're like simple hymns, which is interesting to think all this sort of weird mythic stuff going on in his head and in his sort of illustrations, all that's sort of there. But again, the actual words are very simple. So they invite you, especially the more sort of other poems you look at, to start making connections between them. And one of the questions he's always got in mind is, okay, if this is innocence, is it really? Or is this just naivete, where the innocent don't see how they're being oppressed by somebody? And which way should we look at the world? Should you look at the world from the point of view of a child and be happy about everything? Or should you look at the view at the world from the point of view of someone who's been smashed by it and can see oppression everywhere, and Blake did, and cry out as a prophet against that? And when you read some of the Songs of Experience, they're certainly saying that, but within them, depending on your point of view, the innocent viewpoint can also be seen depending on how you want to read that poem, which is the fallen way of looking at the world. There is something not necessarily pure and right about a child looking at the world and saying, isn't this great, when they're being led by policemen with sticks who've been beating them into sing in St. Paul's Church. And again, I mean, how are we to see that? That's the question that Blake is sort of saying, well, it's somewhere in between, but we better be careful how we think about it. Now, if you'd switch it over to the tiger, I'll let Greg Brown, Iowa folk singer, sing this most famous of Blake's poems for you.
Twist the sinews of thy heart, and In what furnace was that made? What the end was? There is dirty terror's glass.
Great album, really. I mean, it's a great interpretation of Blake's songs, and he went around to parties actually and sang these himself. So I mean, we don't know how he sang them, but I'm sure it was weird. Blake did, yeah. Greg Brown probably does too.
Did he leave musical settings scores for them?
No, I mean he just would go and just sort of record in his early biography that he liked to sing, and he would sing.
What he's talking about here is the overwhelming nature of worldly evil and the all-consuming wrath of God. And I guess I'd love to hear that read by you.
Can you hear the words when he's singing?
About 4/5 of them.
Yeah, well, I can read it.
It needs to be.
Fearful Symmetry is a great... I mean, any line in Blake, again, this principle of synecdoche, name one, and you can start drawing connections to everything else in his work. But Fearful Symmetry is one that, I mean, it's a perfect fit for sort of his method. Even the method of this poem. You got this first stanza and the last stanza are exactly the same, except for one word. It's a symmetrical poem. This poem is related to the Lamb poem. I mean, the Lamb poem is asking this question, little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? I mean, here's a poem with these questions. Did he who make the lamb make thee? He's asking, I mean, similar questions. And again, and the question the readers of these ask is, what's the point of view of the person telling these poems? The person, or who's right? Is the person telling this poem that's sort of worried about the problem of evil in the world, is this poem itself from a fallen perspective, so you don't want to believe it? This is somebody who's wrong that sees the tiger this way, or is this right? But I'll go ahead and read it.
It's, while you're looking up, Martin,
yeah.
It's curious that it's the tiger and not the more obvious choice of the lion.
Yes.
Any thoughts why?
He's got some proverbs about tigers, I mean, and lions. I don't have any good answer. I mean, you would think, I mean, the symmetrical one would be, I mean, the easy answer is, well, it's the fearfully symmetrical answer, but I don't know.
It's more fun to spell tiger.
Yeah. So here's the poem again, and we'll have time to read a couple more of his, I'm going to flash by some. and I'll stop only if there's a tree in it, okay? I mean, that's the rules today. Five, if you see one, you'll... Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand and what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry?
What's the different word?
The first question is, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? And then the last one is, what dare frame thy symmetry?
You know, when you just read that, the line that stood out to me was, when the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears. I was thinking of that first frontispiece that you showed that had the, or maybe it was your first one, but had the tree with what Karen said, you know, looked like lightning branches, and then water coming out of the lightning as if maybe throwing down their spears, and then the teardrops that you mentioned, you know, that heaven is crying with tears. So it's just, you know, similar images. I don't know why, but...
Right.
Well, to Blake, these spears were, it was reason. It was a shock to the world of the power of reason. He is questioning this.
Mm-hmm. And also part of the image in that, I mean, if the stars are throwing spears and then they're watering heaven, where does that put heaven?
Under the stars.
Puts. I mean, how's that? So, I mean, if the world's upside down, I mean, it sort of implies a little bit of that the speaker of this poem can't necessarily be believed to be unfallen, that... To ask these questions are the questions of someone who's falling, and isn't quite seeing the world correctly. Let's flash ahead, and now I'm just at the beginning of Songs, Innocence, Experience. My introduction is over. The other thing I wanted to show you is to show the next. This is the combined title page of the Songs of Innocence and Experience. Go to the next one. There's the same one, different version. You see, they're quite different in their colors, and that's still gone forward to the next. And now you're still going forward. I don't think it goes backwards. But back to this question, if you're facing the romantic dilemma, how do you keep your books and your words alive and from oppressing people? Let's just think about that for a minute. If you're going to put together a book, what are you going to do to keep it open, to keep things different every time you put together one of these books? What might you do to make them unique?
Mass-produced.
Okay, I mean, that's one thing. And so Blake did him himself. I mean, he couldn't bear and all his works he produced this way, he couldn't bear the thought of, in the 18th century, the rise of the bookseller and the rise of literacy. I mean, so you have all kinds of publishing going on, but to take his manuscript over to someone and have him set it in type and print it was death to him. So he did it himself. And this is his own handwriting and his own engraving then. So to do it yourself is one thing. And doing it yourself gives you, I mean, the way he would do this, he'd etch these things in copper plates, and then he and his wife would paint them. And so every one is painted quite differently. You can see very intentionally, the colors are very different. So that last one was actually a very fancy version. And then, so that's one thing you could do. What else could you do if you wanted to like not have it be the same? And Blake hated conventional authority of any type, because conventional authority always led to oppression. I mean, what else are you gonna do if you've got your book of poems and you've got you're gonna paint them differently? I mean, that's one thing.
You could put little twists and turns and tricks in there.
Yeah. You could tempt us to look for like words that might not be there. Or cues in trees, yeah, or to see things. I mean, certainly that's another part. Another thing that he did, he shuffled the pages. He didn't put the poems in the same order in the editions. So some of the Songs of Innocence, he says, oh, well, let's try this. We'll make them a song of experience. Let's take some of the Songs of Experience. We'll put them here. So there's no sort of canonical version of the book. Okay, so keep going. Keep going. That's the frontispiece again. There's this poem. This is the first poem in Songs of Innocence. And I'm just going to flip through some and just look at some of the images here. But we're back to the lamb and the tree. And I want to read this one because that's a great tree. What do you see in that picture before I read it?
A sense of sheltering of the children.
Yeah. So you've got women with kids in their laps, and there's some men in the picture, and there's like, it's like a juggler or something in the background doing some clowning around. Blake didn't have any kids of his own, but he hung around with kids. He liked kids a lot. So you've got the sheltering tree, and this one's called The Echoing Green, and It goes on to the next page, so when I get to the bottom of that one, you can just flip ahead. The sun does arise and make happy the skies. The merry bells ring to welcome the spring. The skylark and thrush, the birds of the bush, sing louder around to the bell's cheerful sound, while our sports shall be seen on the echoing green. Old John with white hair does laugh away care, sitting under the oak among the old folk. They laugh at our play, and soon they all say, such were the joys when we were all girls and boys. In our youth time we're seen on the echoing green. Till the little ones weary, no more can be merry, the sun does descend and our sports have an end. Round the laps of their mothers, many sisters and brothers, like birds in their nest, are ready for rest, and sport no more seen on the darkening green. So what do you see in that picture? Can you even focus it maybe even a tiny more? I wonder if it would. You know where the... It might sharpen up a tiny bit. That's it. Is that a tree?
Vine,
yeah, okay, so it's close enough so we can leave it up here.
It's strong.
Yeah, they're hanging around in it, and there's something growing in it. Can you see what those things are?
Looks like grapes.
Yeah, so there's a fruit tree again. People are handing things out of this tree. What does that make you think of? People sort of handing fruit out of trees. Well, we were back to the fall. I mean, is that a fall? Is it a fortunate fall? I mean, is this a poem about wonderful innocence of children playing out there like they're all doing out here in Holden now? I mean, this is a song of innocence, but in every one of his songs of innocence, you can, if you read it from a different point of view, you can see sort of the dark clouds that are hanging around. I mean, do you have any sense of that in this one, in the text?
Green is dark.
At the very end. I mean, here's these kids. I mean, it's night, but they're growing older. And how long will it be before they're not going to see the world themselves this way? And remember, the old men are sitting around in this thinking, oh, when we were young, wasn't it look great? And those old men, I mean, for a moment, maybe seeing the world this way, but they're making a You're saying that's not the way we see the world right now. And then you have this, you know, cherub in the tree handing down fruit. But again, it recalls the fall that will take place from there.
And the man with the black hat, is he kind of like pointing off into the future, like this is the distance? Is this where you're going?
And that's religious garb that he's got. So he's like a parson of some sort. And Blake doesn't have a high opinion of lots of organized religious leaders, because too often they're pointing someplace, and where they're pointing isn't a place where kids would like to be. And we'll see that in just a second. Let's flash ahead. That's where the lamb shows up, so keep going. This is a poem he's got about the little black boy, which is an interesting poem. We don't have to read it, but Jesus, Blake's ahead of his time in a lot of ways. I mean, feminists like certain aspects of his work because he's real big on women's rights. He's a friend of Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote Vindication of the Rights of Women, early feminist. And, I mean, oppression of any kind he hated, so he doesn't like slavery, the slave trade. So here's a poem about skin color. I'm just going to flash through some. If you see something you want to, like, say, oh, I want to hear that one, just, well, no, you can't. No, because I want to get to Poison Tree. He's got a series of poems about lost and found kids. This is The Little Boy Lost. Keep going. And it's, you know, trees everywhere. There's The Little Boy Found. Just another joke title here. I mean, the title of this poem is The Little Boy Found, probably. But the F looks just like the S in some of his other titles. And this is a poem about a kid making noises. The little boy's sound, I think, is equally possible to read it, but keep going. Laughing song, a party at a table with a jester and clowning. That actually, this one's blurry anyway, but Blake's plate is very blurry on this. It's a night scene, and he's sort of, it's like taking a picture when it's too dark outside. I mean, I think he wanted it to look that way. Okay, keep going. Spring, more sheep, pastoral, and that's the things associated with innocence. Keep going. Nurse's song, again, more playing kids underneath a tree. There's the frontispiece again to experience. And now we're moving into the song of experience. And I'm just going to read one more song of experience to you. Here's the title page. The clod and the pebble. Keep going. That's a funny poem. Holy Thursday. This is what I alluded to a minute ago. He's got a Holy Thursday in innocence and Holy Thursday in experience. Holy Thursday in innocence is this great celebration of this Easter service where kids are all up, the orphans in town are brought into St. Paul's and they sing. I mean, you imagine filling the church with beautiful kids' voices, and it's just this wonderful thing. It sounds like angels. And then this poem asks you to think about the same thing. Why are these kids orphans in the first place? Why are they being dragged in here to entertain all these rich people who are feeling good that they're giving charity to these kids today, but don't do anything about it any of the rest of the year? I mean, how are we to interpret that event? Keep going. The little girl lost. The little girl found. Second page of that. And there's the lion in that one. It showed up. The fly. I want to get to the poison tree because that's what I want to end with. There's the tiger. My pretty rose tree. London, the human abstract. And there it is. It's a crappy slide, but I'm going to end with this one. And I'll read you the poem. Wait. Don't leave me. This is a poison tree. A poison tree, and you may have heard this, it's somewhat, I mean, gets reprinted. I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath did end. I was angry with my foe, I told it not, my wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears, night and morning with my tears, and I sunned it with smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles. And it grew both day and night till it bore an apple bright. And my foe beheld it shine, and he knew that it was mine. And into my garden stole, when the night had veiled the pole. In the morning glad I see my foe outstretched beneath the tree.
What was the name of that?
That's a poison tree.
Snow White.
Sounds like a Snow White story.
Mm-hmm. Can you read it one more time?
Sure, let me. And just look at the position of the dead guy. I mean, what is that position? I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. My wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not. My wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears, night and morning with my tears. And I sunned it with smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles. And it grew both day and night till it bore an apple bright. And my foe beheld it shine, and he knew that it was mine. And into my garden stole, when the night had veiled the pole. In the morning glad I see my foe outstretched beneath the tree. And there's the word veil. It's showing up everywhere.
Yeah, veil the pole. What's the pole?
The, could talk, I mean, it's just this means the sun setting, the sort of east to west lights closing, but it's also the veil between heaven and hell. I mean, this is the Genesis story reinterpreted. Think about that as the beginning of Genesis and what it says about the God who puts that apple tree there in the first place. That God in Genesis is someone who was mad at somebody and wouldn't talk about it. And then Adam sort of walked up and died as a result. That's not how it happened exactly, but Blake wants you to think about that. And if that's true, then Adam and Christ are dead somehow for the same reason, or are related to each other directly, as we saw in some of the images already before. This is also just great Freudian psychology before Freud, you know? I mean, talk things out and they won't, or go get psychoanalysis or you're gonna have some problems in life. I think we are out of time. There are a few books in the bookstore. You can end the tape if you haven't already. Some Blake collections I brought up of some of his selected poems, and they're like $1.50. It's a great value. If you haven't read some Blake poems, they could change your life. Or they could change the way you read, which is probably the same thing. There's some facsimile editions over there of the Songs of Innocence and Experience. If you want to look at the pictures, I think those are like $4. And there's one copy of a bigger volume that's got a whole bunch of his stuff with some really nice color reproductions. It's like $20. But it's got most of his major works in it. So if anybody's interested in Blake, that's a great book to have.
So all of his poetry was illustrated?
Except his earliest stuff, when he was just fooling around in his notebook. This is how he produced them and published them.
And this would be the original size.
Yeah, I mean, the size of the prints are, I mean, they're a little bigger than this book, but they're like that. Yeah, thanks for coming. Blake, with everything you know about John and Revelation, I mean, you're just the perfect reader of Blake, because you would see everything that he's got on his mind. I mean, this notion of the performative.